This is the sample assessment material for the Pearson EdXL International GCSE English as a Second Language Paper 2 Listening Test. This test is in four parts, and you will have to answer questions on what you hear. At the end of each extract, there will be a pause to give you time to read the questions. You will hear all four parts twice. Write your answers in the spaces in your question booklet as you listen. Part 1. Section A. In this section, you will hear five short extracts in which people are talking about places they have visited. Read the list of places below, then listen to the extracts. For each question, 1 to 5, identify which place, A to H, is being described by each speaker by marking a cross for the correct answer. If you change your mind about an answer, put a line through the box and then mark your new answer with a cross. Not all places are described, and each place may be used more than once. One mark will be awarded for each answer. Question 1.
They advertise hundreds of species to see, but we didn't see anywhere near that number. Also, some of the attractions were closed. We saw plenty of butterflies, spiders, donkeys, and chickens, but if you are looking for more exotic animals, go somewhere else. Some of the exhibits were a bit dated as well, but the kids will have a good time.
Question 2.
We had a great day out. It was lovely to see all the animals, and the staff work really hard to keep them healthy and happy. They put so much into looking after old, injured or abandoned horses. We wandered around feeding the ponies and donkeys, and then had tea in the beautiful walled garden.
Question 3.
It's a good day out for both young and old alike. The mountain bikes were great fun, and the treetop climb was challenging but exciting, and the views were fantastic. Going on the zip wire was the best bit, but I wish it had been longer. The staff were friendly and took great care with our safety.
Question 4.
It's magnificent and contains many works of art. The guides are dressed in costumes and they bring the place to life. The architecture is impressive, and we loved wandering around the elegant rooms. The huge kitchens were a highlight. If you prefer the outdoors, the gardens are beautiful and have some superb wildlife.
Question 5.
This is well worth a visit, with plenty to see and something of interest for most people. It has four floors of unbelievable treasures from around the world. In fact, don't expect to see everything in a day. And my favourite was the exhibition of French furniture. The gift shop is also full of lovely items to buy.
Now listen a second time and check your answers. Question 1.
They advertise hundreds of species to see, but we didn't see anywhere near that number. Also, some of the attractions were closed. We saw plenty of butterflies, spiders, donkeys, and chickens, but if you are looking for more exotic animals, go somewhere else. Some of the exhibits were a bit dated as well, but the kids will have a good time.
Question 2.
We had a great day out. It was lovely to see all the animals, and the staff work really hard to keep them healthy and happy. They put so much into looking after old, injured or abandoned horses. We wandered around feeding the ponies and donkeys, and then had tea in the beautiful walled garden.
Question 3.
It's a good day out for both young and old alike. The mountain bikes were great fun, and the treetop climb was challenging but exciting, and the views were fantastic. Going on the zip wire was the best bit, but I wish it had been longer. The staff were friendly and took great care with our safety.
Question 4. It's magnificent and contains many works of art. The guides are dressed in costumes and they bring the place to life. The architecture is impressive, and we loved wandering around the elegant rooms. The huge kitchens were a highlight. If you prefer the outdoors, the gardens are beautiful and have some superb wildlife. Question 5.
This is well worth a visit, with plenty to see and something of interest for most people. It has 4 floors of unbelievable treasures from around the world. In fact, don't expect to see everything in a day. And my favourite was the exhibition of French furniture. The gift shop is also full of lovely items to buy.
That's the end of Part 1, Section A. Now turn to Part 1, Section B. Section B. In this section, you will hear a man talking about selling soft drinks at a music festival. For questions 6 to 10, listen and answer the questions below. Write no more than 3 words for each answer. 1 mark will be awarded for each answer.
It was our first time at a music festival, and although there were some ups and downs, we enjoyed the experience. We planned to get to the festival really early, so we set out in the middle of the night. The roads were empty. We stopped for a coffee and fuel, and then got stuck in a traffic jam 5 miles from the festival venue. The music was about to start when we finally arrived. Fortunately, one of the organisers spotted our predicament and found some volunteers to lend a hand in setting up our stand. They did a fantastic job, so we gave them some of our lemonade as a thank you. It was a hot day, and very soon we had a long queue of people waiting to be served. It was then that we realised we were running short of ice to keep the drinks cool. Once again, we were lucky because the people at a neighbouring stand had plenty and gave us some. By late afternoon, it had become overcast, and at about 7 o'clock, the heavens opened. It was then we discovered something we could have done with, Wellington boots. Although we had remembered to bring along waterproof coats, so it wasn't too bad. In spite of the rain, the music carried on and the festival goers were determined to have a good time. As darkness fell, we started to pack up as people were more interested in finding hot food than buying cold drinks. We then had a chance to watch the bands, which was so good that we decided to stay over that night and leave the next day. We had a delightful evening and really got into the mood of the festival. There was such a warm atmosphere and everyone was enjoying themselves, even the organisers. That's saying something, as we have been to many festivals since then, some of which have, quite frankly, been chaotic. But we have never forgotten the kindness and support we experienced that day.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
It was our first time at a music festival, and although there were some ups and downs, we enjoyed the experience. We planned to get to the festival really early, so we set out in the middle of the night. The roads were empty. We stopped for a coffee and fuel, and then got stuck in a traffic jam 5 miles from the festival venue. The music was about to start when we finally arrived. Fortunately, one of the organisers spotted our predicament and found some volunteers to lend a hand in setting up our stand. They did a fantastic job, so we gave them some of our lemonade as a thank you. It was a hot day, and very soon we had a long queue of people waiting to be served. It was then that that we realised we were running short of ice to keep the drinks cool. Once again, we were lucky because the people at a neighbouring stand had plenty and gave us some. By late afternoon, it had become overcast, and at about 7 o'clock, the heavens opened. It was then we discovered something we could have done with, Wellington boots. Although we had remembered to bring along waterproof coats, so it wasn't too bad. In spite of the rain, the music carried on and the festival goers were determined to have a good time. As darkness fell, we started to pack up as people were more interested in finding hot food than buying cold drinks. We then had a chance to watch the bands, which were so good that we decided to stay over that night and leave the next day. We had a delightful evening and really got into the mood of the festival. There was such a warm atmosphere and everyone was enjoying themselves, even the organisers. That's saying something, as we have been to many festivals since then, some of which have, quite frankly, been chaotic. But we have never forgotten the kindness and support we experienced that day.
That's the end of Part 1, Section B. Now turn to Part 2. Part 2. In this part, you will hear a man talking about cycling. For questions 11 to 18, listen and complete the notes. Write no more than 3 words for each answer. Questions 19 and 20 must be answered with a cross in a box. If you change your mind about an answer, put a line through the box and then mark your new answer with a cross. 1 mark will be awarded for each completed answer.
Hi, I'm Pete Lloyd, and here are my top cycling tips and some advice if you're out on your bike this winter. So, let's start with some suggestions to get you cycling further. The simplest one is to spend more time on your bike. A surefire way of being able to cover longer distances is to increase steadily the length of rides over the course of a few weeks and months. This helps your body to become more efficient and use less energy when you pedal. You need to become stronger if you want to cover longer distances, and a good way to do this is to head out before breakfast. This will go a long way to achieving your strength goals. If you commute by bike, this is an easy change to make to your daily life. You can do loads of training, but if you don't take enough food on a ride, you won't go half as far as you would otherwise. Eating whilst on a ride is absolutely essential, because otherwise your body will run out of usable energy. Top up as you go along on energy bars or something you made before you left the house, such as peanut butter sandwiches. Stay safe on the roads by scanning 20 metres in front of you so you can react safely ahead of time. It sounds obvious, but it's surprisingly easy to forget, as most people tend to focus on their front wheel. This is even more important when taking a corner. Don't be distracted and keep your wits about you. It's easy to think the key to improving as a rider is just to get fitter. This will certainly make you faster, but don't neglect to work on your technique. A particular one that will keep you safe when riding slowly in a group is being able to ride in a straight line. Practice this by riding parallel to the edge of the road. Remember that you aren't safe on a bike if you can't stop. Your front brake is by far the most effective way to slow down. It's really worth getting used to the feeling of this by regularly doing a few emergency stops to know what it's like when you apply the front brake in this way. If you're heading out on your bike this winter, make sure you never set off without a jacket in your backpack. Something lightweight will fold up really small and not take up so much room. You'll be glad of it when it starts raining or if you're stuck by the side of the road. It's important to stay warm in very cold or wet conditions, particularly if you're in a group and someone gets a puncture. Just one or two of you should stop to do the repair. The rest of the group should continue moving, keeping nice and warm until the repair is complete, to reduce the risk of catching a chill. Remember, keep moving if you can. Cold feet are a problem, and woolen socks and overshoes usually do the trick. There are also some new products on the market, such as foot warmers. These are heated insoles which fit snugly inside your cycling shoes and are supposed to keep your feet nice and toasty. They are not very effective to my mind and a bit pricey, so I would rather stick to more tried and tested solutions to cold feet, such as insulated socks. In winter, it's important to be as visible as possible. Standard lights, bright cycle clothing with reflective patches, topped off with a high visibility vest, are the way to go. Flashing bike lights are everywhere now, but remember, you are not a Christmas tree. Super high-powered lights at the front dazzle drivers and won't make you popular with them. And whilst laser lights are great in cities, they are not very useful in poorly lit areas.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
Hi, I'm Pete Lloyd, and here are my top cycling tips and some advice if you're out on your bike this winter. So, let's start with some suggestions to get you cycling further. The simplest one is to spend more time on your bike. A surefire way of being able to cover longer distances is to increase steadily the length of rides over the course of a few weeks and months. This helps your body to become more efficient and use less energy when you pedal. You need to become stronger if you want to cover longer distances, and a good way to do this is to head out before breakfast. This will go a long way to achieving your strength goals. If you commute by bike, this is an easy change to make to your daily life. You can do loads of training, but if you don't take enough food on a ride, you won't go half as far as you would otherwise. Eating whilst on a ride is absolutely essential, because otherwise your body will run out of usable energy. Top up as you go along on energy bars or something you made before you left the house, such as peanut butter sandwiches. Stay safe on the roads by scanning 20 metres in front of you so you can react safely ahead of time. It sounds obvious, but it's surprisingly easy to forget, as most people tend to focus on their front wheel. This is even more important when taking a corner. Don't be distracted and keep your wits about you. It's easy to think the key to improving as a rider is just to get fitter. This will certainly make you faster, but don't neglect to work on your technique. A particular one that will keep you safe when riding slowly in a group is being able to ride in a straight line. Practice this by riding parallel to the edge of the road. Remember that you aren't safe on a bike if you can't stop. Your front brake is by far the most effective way to slow down. It's really worth getting used to the feeling of this by regularly doing a few emergency stops to know what it's like when you apply the front brake in this way. If you're heading out on your bike this winter, make sure you never set off without a jacket in your backpack. Something lightweight will fold up really small and not take up so much room. You'll be glad of it when it starts raining or if you're stuck by the side of the road. It's important to stay warm in very cold or wet conditions, particularly if you're in a group and someone gets a puncture. Just one or two of you should stop to do the repair. The rest of the group should continue moving, keeping nice and warm until the repair is complete, to reduce the risk of catching a chill. Remember, keep moving if you can. Cold feet are a problem, and woolen socks and overshoes usually do the trick. There are also some new products on the market, such as foot warmers. These are heated insoles which fit snugly inside your cycling shoes and are supposed to keep your feet nice and toasty. They are not very effective to my mind and a bit pricey, so I would rather stick to more tried and tested solutions to cold feet, such as insulated socks. In winter, it's important to be as visible as possible. Standard lights, bright cycle clothing with reflective patches, topped off with a high visibility vest, are the way to go. Flashing bike lights are everywhere now, but remember, you are not a Christmas tree. Super high-powered lights at the front dazzle drivers and won't make you popular with them. And whilst laser lights are great in cities, they are not very useful in poorly lit areas.
That's the end of part two. Now turn to part three. Part three. In this part, you will hear an interview with an author. For questions 21 to 25, listen and answer the questions. You do not need to write in full sentences. Questions 26 to 30 must be answered with a cross in a box. If you change your mind about an answer, put a line through the box and then mark your new answer with a cross. One mark will be awarded for each completed answer.
I'd like to welcome my friend and fellow author, Mary Colson, to the studio.
Thank you, Anthony.
Could you tell the listeners when you decided that you wanted to become an author?
I had been running a drama group for children for some time, and one year I decided to put together a comedy sketch for a young people's workshop.
How was it received?
Incredibly well.
And I believe it's still put on in secondary schools.
Yes, amazingly, after all this time. After that, I moved on to short stories and then novels for adults and children.
And what did you enjoy reading as a child?
When I was very young, I adored Roald Dahl. And when I was a bit older, about 11 or 12, I got into John Treese.
That's rather a big jump. John Treese isn't generally regarded as a children's author. He's very humorous, but perhaps a little dark.
That's what appealed, and I think his themes are accessible to young people.
And what about these days?
I'm an immense fan of Sally O'Rourke. She can write the socks off any of us. Everything she does is different. Although I do have reservations about her last novel. It seemed to me that her editor should have stepped in and shortened the last two chapters. Having said that, you can't fault the plot.
Yes, I felt the same. And are there any genres that do not appeal?
Fantasy. Show me a dragon slayer and I clap the book shut.
Really?
The characters are an important element, but too many of them seem to follow a similar pattern. Other people may find them entertaining, but life's too short to get involved in stories that run to 10 volumes.
We'll have to agree to disagree on that one. Anyway, as a writer myself, I often incorporate experiences from my own life into my works. How about you?
I think elements creep in, but if you do write about your friends and family, you have to be very careful to disguise them.
You do. I've discovered that to my cost. I now stick to using the situations I've experienced rather than the people who were involved. It causes fewer heartaches.
As a rule of thumb, I pick just one aspect of a person's character and use that in my writing.
In that way, they never recognise themselves.
Good advice. Would you say that your writing has changed since your first novel?
Yes, absolutely. Hasn't yours?
Well, my first book, Leaving, was very personal, but I think several of yours were.
Yes, especially The Treetops, my third novel, which in a strange way is a very autobiographical novel. But The Secret House was a watershed because it was nothing to do with my real life for the first time. Instead, it was more of a mystery. Then I moved on and became interested in survival, such as in the African Adventure series.
My favourite character in that series is Okri, the farmer's son in Village by the Lake.
Really? My readers tell me they have little sympathy for him because he is mean to his cousin when he is accused of taking the bicycle.
Yes, but he makes up for that in the end by bravely facing up to the actual bicycle thieves.
Only partially, to my mind. He saves his cousin, yes, but he makes sure everyone knows he's the hero.
So, who's your favourite?
I have a soft spot for Danny, the main character in South Africa Cup. If he falls down, he gets back on his feet again.
Yes. There's a lot to admire in him, although his relationship with Chris is difficult. Danny's very competitive deep down, but he wants Chris to respect him.
Chris is more competitive and in many ways a stronger character. When Danny's trying out for the team, Chris tackles him and Danny gets knocked out. Yet Danny's so determined to succeed that he goes back to finish the match.
He certainly earned Chris's respect from then on. Now, Mary, you have been writing novels for young and old for over 30 years. What do you think has allowed you to have such a long and successful career?
Well, I make it a rule never to sign a contract until I've finished a book. This means that I never have to rush to a deadline. I'm never being nagged by publishers. And I take my time to get it right. I set a high standard in what I submit, and I put that down to never having to work against the clock.
A lot less stressful, certainly, but it must have been hard at the start of your career.
Sure, I was struggling financially in the early days, but I wanted that freedom.
What can we expect to see from you in the future?
If I'm very honest, I've really been coasting this year, spending a lot of time with my grandchildren. Grandparenting has come as a massive surprise. Lovely and such a gift. Of course, there are a couple of things I've done for reluctant readers, but essentially nothing that has taken my concentration. Yet, come September, I'll be ready to start. I've already got an idea for a children's book about a family and mistaken identity, so watch this space. Now listen a second time and check your answers.
I'd like to welcome my friend and fellow author, Mary Colson, to the studio.
Thank you, Anthony.
Could you tell the listeners when you decided that you wanted to become an author?
I had been running a drama group for children for some time, and one year I decided to put together a comedy sketch for a young people's workshop.
How was it received?
Incredibly well.
And I believe it's still put on in secondary schools.
Yes, amazingly, after all this time. After that, I moved on to short stories and then novels for adults and children.
And what did you enjoy reading as a child?
When I was very young, I adored Roald Dahl. And when I was a bit older, about 11 or 12, I got into John Treese.
That's rather a big jump. John Treese isn't generally regarded as a children's author. He's very humorous, but perhaps a little dark.
That's what appealed, and I think his themes are accessible to young people.
And what about these days?
I'm an immense fan of Sally O'Rourke. She can write the socks off any of us. Everything she does is different. Although I do have reservations about her last novel. It seemed to me that her editor should have stepped in and shortened the last two chapters. Having said that, you can't fault the plot.
Yes, I felt the same. And are there any genres that do not appeal?
Fantasy. Show me a dragon slayer and I clap the book shut.
Really?
The characters are an important element, but too many of them seem to follow a similar pattern. Other people may find them entertaining, but life's too short to get involved in stories that run to 10 volumes.
We'll have to agree to disagree on that one. Anyway, as a writer myself, I often incorporate experiences from my own life into my works. How about you?
I think elements creep in, but if you do write about your friends and family, you have to be very careful to disguise them.
You do. I've discovered that to my cost. I now stick to using the situations I've experienced rather than the people who were involved. It causes fewer heartaches.
As a rule of thumb, I pick just one aspect of a person's character and use that in my writing. In that way, they never recognise themselves.
Good advice. Would you say that your writing has changed since your first novel?
Yes, absolutely. Hasn't yours?
Well, my first book, Leaving, was very personal, but I think several of yours were.
Yes, especially The Treetops, my third novel, which in a strange way is a very autobiographical novel. But The Secret House was a watershed because it was nothing to do with my real life for the first time. Instead, it was more of a mystery. Then I moved on and became interested in survival, such as in the African Adventure series.
My favourite character in that series is Okri, the farmer's son in Village by the Lake.
Really? My readers tell me they have little sympathy for him because he is mean to his cousin when he is accused of taking the bicycle.
Yes, but he makes up for that in the end by bravely facing up to the actual bicycle thieves.
Only partially, to my mind. He saves his cousin, yes, but he makes sure everyone knows he's the hero.
So, who's your favourite?
I have a soft spot for Danny, the main character in South Africa Cup. If he falls down, he gets back on his feet again.
Yes. There's a lot to admire in him, although his relationship with Chris is difficult. Danny's very competitive deep down, but he wants Chris to respect him.
Chris is more competitive and in many ways a stronger character. When Danny's trying out for the team, Chris tackles him and Danny gets knocked out. Yet Danny's so determined to succeed that he goes back to finish the match.
He certainly earned Chris's respect from then on. Now, Mary, you have been writing novels for young and old for over 30 years. What do you think has allowed you to have such a long and successful career?
Well, I make it a rule never to sign a contract until I've finished a book. This means that I never have to rush to a deadline. I'm never being nagged by publishers. And I take my time to get it right. I set a high standard in what I submit, and I put that down to never having to work against the clock.
A lot less stressful, certainly, but it must have been hard at the start of your career.
Sure, I was struggling financially in the early days, but I wanted that freedom.
What can we expect to see from you in the future?
If I'm very honest, I've really been coasting this year, spending a lot of time with my grandchildren. Grandparenting has come as a massive surprise, lovely and such a gift. Of course, there are a couple of things I've done for reluctant readers, but essentially nothing that has taken my concentration. Yet, come September, I'll be ready to start. I've already got an idea for a children's book about a family and mistaken identity, so watch this space. That's the end of part three. Now turn to part four. Part four. In this part, you will hear an extract from a radio program about fish farming. For questions 31 to 32 and 38 to 40, listen and complete the sentences below. Write no more than three words for each answer. For questions 33 to 37, complete the table. Write no more than three words for each answer. One mark will be awarded for each answer.
Welcome to Science World. Today we're talking to Dr. Tina Broadstone about fish farming. Dr. Broadstone, could you start by telling us what fish farming is?
Certainly. Fish farming, which is also known as aquaculture, is the breeding of fish, plants, and other animals in water. This can be carried out in natural bodies of water, such as ponds, lakes, and the ocean, or in man-made tanks. Typical species that are bred in fish farms are shellfish, such as oysters, mussels, and shrimps, and finfish, such as salmon and trout. Some fish farms are devoted to the raising of frogs, but such operators are very much less common and found almost exclusively in Asia.
I see. And how important is aquaculture in economic terms?
Aquaculture is currently the fastest growing food sector in the world. In the last 20 years, it has grown by a good 8% per annum. Today, about 60 million tons of fish and other aquatic animals are farmed around the world every year. This is almost equal to the amount of commercially caught fish, which totaled 78.9 million tons in 2011. Studies indicate that fish farming will continue to grow strongly and make a significant contribution to feeding the world's population and, at the same time, protect the ocean's fish stocks.
This all sounds very positive.
Yes. For example, much less feedstuff is needed to farm fish and seafood than to raise land-based animals. It takes 15 times as much feed to produce 1 kilo of beef as to produce 1 kilo of salmon. Aquaculture, therefore, has the potential to be a tremendous source of protein for human consumption, which makes fewer demands on resources.
But I understand that the industry is not without its critics.
There are certainly issues. The main one is that most farmed fish are currently fed on a diet of fish meal and fish oils, which are mostly made from anchovies and sardines, which live in the wild. It seems nonsensical, but many wild fish stocks have been reduced to critical levels simply in order to feed farmed fish. In fact, fish farming could be seen as a contributor to the problem of overfishing.
The industry's approach to animal health has also earned it something of a bad name.
Yes. Many operators farm fish intensively, but if they are kept in this way, they are more susceptible to disease. Antibiotics are widely used as a preventative measure, but there are already signs that they are no longer effective. It is imperative, therefore, that their use in food production is closely monitored and restricted.
And I understand that there is a particular problem with certain fish farming operations.
Yes. This relates to businesses which farm fish in cages in the open sea, which have direct contact with surrounding waters. In many instances, farmed fish have escaped from their cages, and in time, they have transferred disease to the wild populations. Sometimes these escaped fish have bred prolifically and completely crowded out indigenous populations. Particularly in coastal waters, the resulting environmental damage has been considerable. On one island off the Netherlands, for example, cultivation of the Pacific oyster had to be abandoned, as it had a catastrophic effect on the native blue mussels.
And then there is the question of the waste from aquaculture facilities.
This has come in for some hefty criticism, particularly for those based on the land. It is particularly high in phosphorus and is often allowed to enter rivers and coastal bays untreated. In large quantities, it disrupts the natural chemical balance in the water and causes dead zones to develop.
But attempts are being made to improve the industry's image.
Yes. A number of research groups are trying to find the most sustainable model of fish farming. They have concluded that inland ponds are the least efficient because, amongst other things, they consume vast amounts of energy. But they also found that one inland fish farming model may be a sign of the future. It's called aquaponics, and it is where fish and vegetables are produced in the same facility together. Fish waste provides food for the plants, and the plants purify the water. This is called a closed-loop system. When animals and plants are combined with skill, these aquaponics facilities can be quite self-sufficient, as operators neither have to feed the fish nor process the water. So far, aquaponics has been found to work well in small-scale operations. The industry is also experiencing pressure from consumers to produce goods which comply with environmental standards. For some years, there has been labelling for canned fish, such as tuna, which have been caught using sustainable methods, and products bearing this label are very popular. It is expected that soon there will be a similar certificate for the aquaculture industry, and producers wishing to obtain one must undertake to protect species, the environment, and the water in farmed areas, and comply with a high level of social standards. It is hoped that with such measures in place, there will be a bright future for fish farming.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
Welcome to Science World. Today we are talking to Dr. Tina Broadstone about fish farming. Dr. Broadstone, could you start by telling us what fish farming is?
Certainly. Fish farming, which is also known as aquaculture, is the breeding of fish, plants, and other animals in water. This can be carried out in natural bodies of water, such as ponds, lakes, and the ocean, or in man-made tanks. Typical species that are bred in fish farms are shellfish, such as oysters, mussels, and shrimps, and finfish, such as salmon and trout. Some fish farms are devoted to the raising of frogs, but such operators are very much less common and found almost exclusively in Asia.
I see. And how important is aquaculture in economic terms?
Aquaculture is currently the fastest growing food sector in the world. In the last 20 years, it has grown by a good 8% per annum. Today, about 60 million tons of fish and other aquatic animals are farmed around the world every year. This is almost equal to the amount of commercially caught fish, which totaled 78.9 million tons in 2011. Studies indicate that fish farming will continue to grow strongly and make a significant contribution to feeding the world's population and, at the same time, protect the ocean's fish stocks.
This all sounds very positive.
Yes. For example, much less feedstuff is needed to farm fish and seafood than to raise land-based animals. It takes 15 times as much feed to produce 1 kilo of beef as to produce 1 kilo of salmon. Aquaculture, therefore, has the potential to be a tremendous source of protein for human consumption, which makes fewer demands on resources.
But I understand that the industry is not without its critics.
There are certainly issues. The main one is that most farmed fish are currently fed on a diet of fish meal and fish oils, which are mostly made from anchovies and sardines, which live in the wild. It seems nonsensical, but many wild fish stocks have been reduced to critical levels simply in order to feed farmed fish. In fact, fish farming could be seen as a contributor to the problem of overfishing.
The industry's approach to animal health has also earned it something of a bad name.
Yes. Many operators farm fish intensively, but if they are kept in this way, they are more susceptible to disease. Antibiotics are widely used as a preventative measure, but there are already signs that they are no longer effective. It is imperative, therefore, that their use in food production is closely monitored and restricted.
And I understand that there is a particular problem with certain fish farming operations.
Yes. This relates to businesses which farm fish in cages in the open sea, which have direct contact with surrounding waters. In many instances, farmed fish have escaped from their cages, and in time, they have transferred disease to the wild populations. Sometimes these escaped fish have bred prolifically and completely crowded out indigenous populations. Particularly in coastal waters, the resulting environmental damage has been considerable. On one island off the Netherlands, for example, cultivation of the Pacific oyster had to be abandoned, as it had a catastrophic effect on the native blue mussels.
And then there is the question of the waste from aquaculture facilities.
This has come in for some hefty criticism, particularly for those based on the land. It is particularly high in phosphorus and is often allowed to enter rivers and coastal bays untreated. In large quantities, it disrupts the natural chemical balance in the water and causes dead zones to develop.
But attempts are being made to improve the industry's image.
Yes. A number of research groups are trying to find the most sustainable model of fish farming. They have concluded that inland ponds are the least efficient because, amongst other things, they consume vast amounts of energy. But they also found that one inland fish farming model may be a sign of the future. It's called aquaponics, and it is where fish and vegetables are produced in the same facility together. Fish waste provides food for the plants, and the plants purify the water. This is called a closed-loop system. When animals and plants are combined with skill, these aquaponics facilities can be quite self-sufficient, as operators neither have to feed the fish nor process the water. So far, aquaponics has been found to work well in small-scale operations. The industry is also experiencing pressure from consumers to produce goods which comply with environmental standards. For some years, there has been labelling for canned fish, such as tuna, which have been caught using sustainable methods, and products bearing this label are very popular. It is expected that soon there will be a similar certificate for the aquaculture industry, and producers wishing to obtain one must undertake to protect species, the environment, and the water in farmed areas, and comply with a high level of social standards. It is hoped that with such measures in place, there will be a bright future for fish farming.
That is the end of the test. Please wait for your question booklets to be collected. Thank you and good luck.